Edward Bertinsky is here. Over the last four decades, he has changed the way we perceive our planet and the effects of humanity on the natural world. His large format photographs capture landscapes affected by industry. The results can be fascinating, surreal, or simply disturbing. He was the first to win the TED Prize for Innovation and Global Thinking in 2005. In 2016, he received the Governor General's Award in Visual and Media Arts. His latest major project is In the Wake of Progress, Immersive, a new epic immersive experience. It's in conjunction with the Illuminato Festival this year. It made its world premiere on June 11th and 12th here in the city. During In the Wake of Progress, you walk through as 30-foot screens surround you, Bertinsky's powerful photographs enveloping your senses, telling the story of humanity's impact on the planet, the urgency of the climate crisis, and the quest for positive change. Canadian music legend Bob Ezrin is producer on the project, the man behind everything from Alice Cooper to Pink Floyd's The Wall. Phil Strong is the composer of the original score. There are augmented reality elements as well. In the Wake of Progress dares us to have an important conversation about where we're going as a species. It's on now through July 17th at the Canadian Opera Company Theatre. EdwardBertinsky.com or LuminatoFestival.com for timing and tickets. Edward Bertinsky, welcome to the New Classical FM and the Oasis.
Great to be here, Mark.
This is such a fascinating project, and I have to say, just from personal experiences, seeing your exhibits, experiencing your films, I'm forever changed, seared into my memory, your incredible images. I think of the factories of China, the excavation projects you've shot, the mining slag in Sudbury. Talk to us about the alchemy that led to your photographs becoming this portal into the effects of industry on this planet. What compelled you to want to start taking these images?
It's actually in a very interesting and also Canadian way. I fell in love with the natural world. I was an avid camper. I love fishing. I love going north with my father as a young kid, and it's always been part of my DNA. And I think not understanding as a young person, but kind of somehow getting that sense that I was actually peering into deep time, that this was, and I used to always think, you know, if I was in remote areas, like this forest probably looked like this thousands of years ago, yeah. Or, you know, I'm actually witnessing maybe this part of the forest that no human has seen for maybe a century. I used to be kind of thinking along those lines. And then it also occurred to me that, you know, that pristine untouched landscape is a window and is a reminder of what the planet had plan for that space. And so we're used to living in cities and we're used to, you know, seeing our built environment and we think this is normal, but that this isn't really, you know, what the planet intended. And so it's out of that understanding and out of that knowing that as we succeed as humans, what's being pushed back is what the planet had originally intended in that space. So, and not to say that it doesn't change. I mean, we've had glaciations and we've had, you know, meteor impacts and all of that. But what's interesting now is we are so successful that we have become the equivalent of a meteor impact.
Is there a first moment where you thought, okay, I want to somehow capture this almost alien landscape, where that starts to propel you into what you ultimately become so famous for? I mean, tell us about those early days where you first started taking photographs of altered landscapes.
Painting was something that I fell in love with first. And I used to paint alongside my father as a kid, and he painted in oils, and we used to mix the oil with linseed oil. I painted landscapes. And even when I was seven, he gave me my first brushes, and I used to paint on the back of Masonite and paint landscapes. And then I got a camera when I was 11, and I just thought, oh, this is much quicker. And it was more fun for me. It was more immediate. As a kid, I could just run out there and take a picture of a landscape. And then, you know, a couple of days later when I developed a film, in this magic orange light comes this thing that I just saw all composed in a beautiful frame. And I thought, oh man, this is way faster than painting. Mm-hmm. And I get to hang out with my kids and then with my, you know, kid friends and do the things that kids love to do. So it always kind of was at my side and I always used it. And then, but never at that time did I ever think that, you know, there was a possibility that I could ever make a living or a career. It was just a passion for seeing the three-dimensional world compressed into this two-dimensional space, and the magic of photography that, I mean, this is way before digital. This is in the, in the early 70s, even in the late 60s, I should say. And so that to me was, a kind of a default mode of creating. I just loved it. It was natural to me. And then when I kind of started to mature with it and realized that I could maybe make a go of it as an artist, I went and did landscape, and I thought, this isn't going to get me something that the world hasn't seen. And it didn't feel true to my time. And I thought, if I'm going to make work, and if I'm going to make work that's memorable, somehow it needs to key into the time I'm living. And I was looking around, and I'd seen industry, and I also saw the fact that very few people get to see what being a natural resource economy looks like. We know we are one, but who's been to those open pit mines, and who's seen deforestation, and who's seen the factories where our stuff comes from? So it was really that being the witness and using the camera, and also then going back to that love of painting. I looked at painters, and I've looked at the abstract expressionists, and I've looked at where a lot of our art has come from, the kind of styles, the kinds of ways of thinking, the image plane, the flattening of space, the all-overness. And I started to incorporate a lot of those things that I loved in painting, but I started using the camera almost as a brush and trying to think of my images as paintings. And very much in these worlds that I went to, there's an abstraction. There's a crazy surrealness to them. They do look like alien planets that is not from our planet, but yet they are ours. And that's what I'm trying to do, is I'm trying to say, look, we create these worlds, and they're part of our everyday world, but but we just never get a chance to see it. And the scale of it is just like the scale of our metropolitan cities.
I mean, you've been doing this for a very long time, and we've seen exhibits and film, and now this new exhibit that is here in Toronto. And it just seems like you only have more examples to work with as the decades go by as well. This isn't a diminishing situation.
It isn't a diminishing situation, but there's only so many things that we do. I mean, we extract resources, we build bridges, we deforest, we farm. So a lot of those themes I've already touched on, and this piece, In the Wake of Progress, is a kind of summation of a lot of those ideas. And, and it's buttressed by landscape on either side of the 22-minute piece. But the content, the center of it is the disruption that we cause on the planet. So I do somehow feel like it is like a book I'm putting out into the world. This kind of complete thought that took me 40 years to do, and it's something that I feel. I just saw it actually for the first time in the way I realized it 3 years ago. I'm at the COC right now, and we just ran it on the three screens, which run over 100 feet, and it's all high def 4K projectors, big sound that Bob Ezrin has produced, and all of that together. I'm finally seeing it for the first time, and realizing it. And I did it today after 3 years of thinking about it, and I'm happy to say it has lived up to my realization. It's pretty incredible to see 3-4K projectors. Taking this work, which is all high resolution work that I've shot from the very beginning in the 1980s, I was shooting with 4x5. So I have the resolution even back from, 40 years ago, that'll match these screens. And when you see it all together, it is quite a profound, I think, experience of the world that we've made.
Is there a scene as you've roamed around our globe, and as you point out, a lot of your success is based on the access that you've given us to some of these scenes. But as you've gone around the globe, is there a scene that has stayed with you that is particularly alarming, one that really did take your breath away?
It features proudly, and it's also one of the posters as well. It's a sheep breaking yards in Bangladesh, which was kind of like my halfway mark. It was over 20 years ago. So, which I got the opportunity, I could never get there again. They wouldn't let me in. In fact, I would say over half of what I've got in this can never be done again, because all the stuff I had access to in China is no longer available. All the stuff I got in Russia is no longer available. The stuff in Bangladesh, I tried to go back there, it's no longer available. So the people won't let me in. So, you know, you're seeing something that actually can't be captured any longer. It's no one's allowed. So, you know, but that Bangladesh moment was a real eye opener for me. What the consequence of globalism means when you see these, you know, poor farmer kids that are 18 and even younger, you know, with welding torches, cutting oil tankers, the biggest vessels built by humans, with nothing more than a cutting torch, no safety glasses, no safety boots, just cutting away all day long, burning out their retinas, and having that marine paint, you know, smoke into their face. They, none of these, you know, guys would live more than 25 or 30. And it was like watching the Industrial Revolution at its very beginning, you know, Dickens' time, where, you know, life was cheap and people were dying from pollutants. And you know, it was like witnessing that in our time. So that still stands as one of the most unbelievable sights. And then when a part of these ships would, you know, finally break off and fall into the ocean as they cut them, it was like nothing I've ever heard. The sound and the thump that it makes was unbelievable. These are the biggest vessels, you know, built by humans, these oil tankers.
I have seen the images. And I mean, where does that leave you after all this and putting this exhibit together? What's your take on the Earth and humanity right now? I mean, is it even possible to be optimistic with all you've had to absorb?
Well, it's a tough one, and I don't want to say I'm pessimistic, but I'm not feeling overly optimistic, put it that way, in that we're not moving that at the speed we need to be moving, because it's really at this point literally a 10-alarm fire. And although the fire is not at our doorstep, it's coming, and we see, you know, little vignettes of it, you know, more and more often, whether it's the storms we're seeing or the droughts that we're seeing or the fires and all of that that's coming our way. But it is something that's kind of, it's hard to turn on the TV or open up a paper and not be reminded that the world is changing. So it's not something that is in the distant future. It's now here. But it's a question of recognizing and wanting to recognize it. And then, of course, it's like, but, you know, how do you not, you know, throw up your hands in exasperation and say, but what can I do?
Sure.
You know, this is so big, it's beyond, you know, how do we get away from farming the way we do? How do we get away from eating meat? How do we get away from flying jets? How do we get away from driving, you know, cars with gas? And how do we stop burning gas and oil and coal and all of that? And each one of these things is a huge problem. But I think that if we care about the next generations and if we have kids and we care about their lives that lie ahead of them, I think we all do everything that we can and implore our politicians to put in the policies that make a playing field that's right for the planet and that we can all live with, and to take some brave steps. And so it is a time of action. The time for words has now passed. If we don't start acting, then, you know, we lose control of it. And then once we lose control of it, there's nothing in the human toolkit that we have that can bring it back that I've read about or heard about. It's like once those positive feedback loops take hold, then we just go for that ride.
You touched on it a moment ago, but this is really your creation from the ground up, your vision of your work. So for us listening right now, trying to imagine the experience, what did you have in mind? And it seems like it's come to fruition.
Yeah, and that's actually very exciting because, you know, I feel very privileged as an artist to kind of work my own team and curate the whole thing with my team. So it's totally unmediated. It's directly from the artist studio to, you know, into kind of the public realm. And the way I've built the experience is you come in and there's an interstitial period where you're just in a forest. You're in an ancient forest in Canada. It's on Vancouver Island. I wanted to bring it back to this notion of a forest that's never been cut. This is what nature provided us. This is that place, that place I was talking about when I was younger, and the reference point to what the planet intended in that space. And then, you know, we have that, and during that interstitial period, while you're waiting for it to start, you know, there are small little surprises and, Easter eggs in there, little things that pop up, birds that fly by and you know, things that happen in this still. So I've animated that still image. It took quite a skilled animator to do that. And it took almost 4 months for us to figure out how to do that, to make it really feel real.
Wow.
And then you go into the actual piece itself, which is 22 minutes. And it takes you through the journey of my work and through all the different things I talked about, from, the forest to deforestation to manufacturing, resource extraction, on and on and on, and manufacturing waste stream. And then kind of through water back into the forest experience, to be kind of optimistic and feeling of hope at the other end of it. And that's kind of the 22 minute piece. And again, Phil Strong's score is quite remarkable. And, producer Bob Ezrin also, put the music together in terms of...
Let me jump in there. I'll just point out Bob Ezrin has been on the show here before, and I was very tempted to nerd out with him about Pink Floyd and Jane's Addiction Records, but just a brilliant guy. And I guess you guys know each other. I mean, what drew him to this to want to take part?
Well, we kind of connected by phone back in, I think, 2015. And then, through a mutual friend who was dying, he connected us up again. And we kind of, again, started talking to each other and realized we both had a deep passion for the environment. And then we had a dinner at my place together. Sorry, it was a lunch at my place together. And we really hit it off. And I told him what I was working on. And he said, I'd love to see it. It sounds like what the world needs, And then I showed it to him. And he said, I think I can help you here with the music. And I said, seriously? And he said, yeah. And so, and that began our relationship about, 3 years ago on this piece. And now we're on the other side of it. He was here this morning tuning up the room, and just loved the piece and was really thrilled to be, to see it finally come to fruition. So that's the piece itself. And then there's been a great team, and Luminato's been a great team to help us get it this far. And then once you finish that piece, I thought, well, what do you do to kind of, come off of that, and what would be another experience? So I thought, seeing the actual real images that I actually work towards as an artist, the big prints. So there's an exhibition of about 15 large prints and some very large murals, 10 by 20 foot murals. So you leave the space and you walk through and see some of my imagery kind of up close and personal, and see the kind of detail and the kinds of things that you wouldn't catch in the experience, but now you can see the actual prints and images and in a whole new way. And then I figured that's about a 20 minute to half hour experience. And then at the then we have a change station midway through, where you can look at different things that I've been involved in terms of ways in which NGOs that have been working on water and deforestation and all of that and environmental defense and the work they do. So just things where people can become aware of, how do I engage? And then on the way out, there's an AR experience that I've built in, where I have two AR experiences that are looking at the internal combustion engine as the kind of core technology that has brought us to this existential moment. And so I have one, the work of a whole group of guys who break engines in Ghana, in Accra. And so at the end of the day, they'd have this pile of engine parts. So there's three piles, one engine and two piles that you can look at through an AR experience. And then there's another engine that I've captured in 3D, which is one of the largest engines ever built, 4,500 horsepower, I think 16 cylinder engine that's used to move 400 ton ore trucks for mining companies. And it was on a shop floor being worked on. So I captured it with over 3,000 images, turned it into a 3D image. Now you can kind of, with an iPad or your own phone, you can look at this humongous engine. The engine itself was 12 feet high and about 18 feet long when I was capturing it. So it took me almost a half a day to capture it as a 3D image. And you get to kind of walk around that engine and contemplate it as one of the kind of machinery it takes to create those landscapes that you just saw.
Are you planning to take this on tour?
Yes, it is. We've got a bunch of locations that we're still negotiating with, so we don't want to really speak up. But yes, this whole thing has been planned to roll out as a tour, and then I see it, you know, being out there in the world for quite some time. And we built smaller versions, so eventually, you know, once we do the main tour, we might be able to start touring it into smaller community centers. So we have another half scale model of this that can fit into an auditorium at a school or a community center. So I'm hoping to that it has a great life out there, that it touches, because I think it's important that people, I think there's no words spoken in it. It's just sound and images, music and images, and voice and vocals. And Iskwe, by the way, did the vocals on it. She's a First Nations singer also performed during Luminato. Mm. And she's great to work with. And her vocals are absolutely haunting through the piece. And so, you know, I'm looking at it is, this is something as an artist I can do. I can get people to see something and feel something about it, and to touch you at right where it kind of hurts in a way, or right where you re-feel it. And then from there, I think it's an inflection point to really begin to consider our world. So in many ways, it's a way to synthesize so many things that we're doing in the world in 20 minutes, and in a way to kind of make us sit back for a moment and really contemplate, you know, what is it to be human today with 8 billion people on the planet, and how it's changing, and to get us out of our comfort zone of our own, you know, small orbits, and then to say, no, we are part of a larger system that we have to care about. So, and I think if that even changes, a handful of people out there to make a difference, and those people can make a huge difference, you know, that's what it's about. Or kids see it and they change their direction in life and say, I'm going to do something about this. But I see it as an inflection point. But I don't think you can get there until you appreciate and absorb that it is an issue. It is something that's up to us to do something about. And until we actually own that, until we take it on as a personal agenda, nothing changes. So it is that, you know, raising consciousness and shaping consciousness is really the true beginning of change.
And I do like the idea as well, something you talked about at the beginning of our conversation, that when you were first seeing those forests and realizing you were looking back into history some way, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot too, that we need to be thinking in centuries, if we can. We need to be thinking long term, and I think that's something that's very, very difficult for us to grasp in this very busy modern age we're in right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's the foundation I belong to, the Long Now Foundation, mm-hmm. and they propose 10,000 year thinking, you know, and that we should think in 10,000 year blocks of time, and we're nowhere near that.
No.
But it is great to kind of contemplate the kinds of mental rigor it takes to think in that kind of time horizon. But we're now thinking, we actually think in terms of our own life, actually, in probably like an 80-year time horizon. And then corporate thinking is 4 months, you know, and in government re-election thinking is 4 years. So, you know, we need, you know, a much greater, you know, arc of thinking in terms of, you know, what are we doing today? And the First Nations and their seven generations is very enlightened, and there's lots to be learned there.
Edward Bertinsky, we could go on. I'm such an admirer of your work, and thank you for sharing what you have seen around the world with those of us who just wouldn't understand without those images. And it's just been a real privilege to talk to you here this afternoon.
Thanks, Mark.